Chapter 3 Interlude. What makes God godlike? In Exodus, the second book of the Bible, the Lord will return with sudden, violent force, ending his relative absence from the last chapters of the book of Genesis. Before looking in detail at the character he assumes on his return, we might pause to consider what it is in literary terms that makes God as we know him at this point godlike. What makes him different? God, and in this brief interlude we intend the word God to mean not Elohim, but the protagonist of the Tanakh in as much complexity as has appeared by the end of the book of Genesis, is in the most basic sense of the word the protagonist, the protos agonistes or first actor of the Bible. He does not enter the human scene. He creates the human scene that he then enters. He creates the human antagonist whose interaction with him shapes all the subsequent action. This is his first and most obvious distinguishing feature. If God's priority makes his human antagonist uniquely dependent on him, it is nonetheless also true that God is uniquely dependent on his human antagonist, and that this dependence complicates the attempt to do what we are doing, namely to read the Bible as God's story. For though human dependence on God is never denied in the Bible, in practice much of what humans are seen doing in it has a natural autonomy that is unmatched by anything that God is seen doing. By no means all the human action reported in the Bible joins mankind to God as antagonist to protagonist, but the reverse is not true. None of the divine action reported in the Bible is unlinked to human beings. None of it is, in that sense, purely divine. God takes no action that does not have man as its object. There are no adventures of God. This is, up to a point, the inevitable result of monotheism. Polytheistic Greek mythology includes some stories that tell of intervention by Zeus in human affairs, but others that tell of Zeus's life among his fellow gods. In the Bible, God, being the only God, does not have that second kind of action through which to present himself. But the peculiarity of God's character does not end there. God could conceivably engage in some kind of demonstrative action that would serve his own self-presentation, apart from any interaction with man. Miraculous displays, cosmic disruptions, the creation of other worlds. But in fact, he refrains from all such activity. Not only does he lack any social life among other gods, but he also lacks what we might call a private life. His only way of pursuing an interest in himself is through mankind. God's words show the same symbiotic character as his deeds. Even lacking, as he does, all divine companionship, he is, to begin with, without a consort. Why does God never talk to himself? Surely the divine mind could open itself in discursive soliloquy, but it does not. In the opening scenes of the book of Genesis, the creation and the flood, something close to soliloquy is heard. From that point on, however, all of God's speech is directed at man, and in most cases, it is also directive of man. God is like a novelist who is literally incapable of autobiography or criticism, and can only tell his own story through his characters. Moreover, he can only deal with his characters creatively. His only creative tactic with them is direction. He tells them what to do, so that they will be what he wants them to be. He is not interested in them in their own right. He does not deal with them analytically. He is always directive, never appreciative. As for the concrete particulars of what God wants mankind to be, this he only discovers as he goes along. His manner is always supremely confident, but he does not announce or seem even to know all his plans in detail or in advance. Again and again God is displeased with man, but often enough it seems that he discovers only in and through his anger just what pleases him. To change the analogy slightly, he is like a director whose actors never seem to get it right, and who is, as a result, often angry, but who doesn't himself always know beforehand what getting it right will be. When the actors get it wrong, he too gets it wrong, until finally they get it more or less right, and he calms down enough to admit it. Getting it right is, in the Bible, not just a matter of mankind's observing the law of God. At this point in the story, the law has not even been given. It is rather, and much more broadly, a matter of mankind's becoming the image of God. That quest, arising from the protagonist's soul-stated motive, drives the only real plot that the Bible can be said to have. But that plot, God's attempt to shape mankind in His image, would be far more comprehensible if God had a richer subjective life, one more clearly separate from, more clearly prior to, the human object of His shaping. As it is, the plot of the Bible is difficult and elusive in a way that is intimately related to the difficulty and elusiveness of God as its protagonist. Experience shapes character, and character determines action. A character totally without experience is all but a contradiction in terms. If such a character could exist at all, we would scarcely know what to expect of him or what it would mean to be shaped in his image. True, we are well enough accustomed, in life and in literature, to see an innocent character living through new, sometimes painful experiences, and so undergoing a character development. But that innocence, that lack of experience, is always only a relative lack. A country boy come to the big city does, when all is said and done, have 18 or so years of history behind him. It is that history that makes him comprehensible to us. How would we understand him if, chronologically, he were 18, but characterologically a parentless newborn babe? His character would then necessarily lie entirely in his future rather than in his past. He could only be what he would become, and so, at the outset, he could only be a kind of living question mark. God, though we have managed to say a good deal about him in the book of Genesis, is this kind of living question mark, a wholly prospective character. He has no history, no genealogy, no past that in the usual way of literature might be progressively introduced into his story to explain his behavior and induce some kind of catharsis in the reader. No human character could be so fully without a past and still be human. And yet we may see that by giving this inhuman character words to speak in human language, and deeds to do in interaction with human beings, the writers of the Bible have created a new literary possibility. God frustrates our ordinary literary expectations, shaped as they are by the expectations that we have of other human beings when we meet them. We expect to learn who they are by learning how their past has led to their present. This is, almost by definition, what makes any human character interesting and coherent. God is not interesting or coherent in this way. That the Greek gods had recognizably human bodies was ultimately less important to their anthropomorphism than that they had genealogies and desires, pasts and futures. God has neither. And the stray anthropomorphisms of detail that appear in the book of Genesis are dwarfed by that overwhelming fact. We must think of God as newborn and yet not a babe. His possibilities not confined within the boundaries of human experience, and yet, paradoxically, not to be realized unless in relationship with human beings. His manner in the book of Genesis is, very roughly, that of a man of unreflective self-confidence, intrusive to aggressive habits, and unpredictable eloquence, but above all a man who discloses nothing about his past and next to nothing about his needs or desires. When the adjective godlike refers implicitly to this God, Adam's maker and Abraham's partner, rather than say to the youthful, physically beautiful, and brilliant Apollo, it signifies a set of qualities like those just mentioned. And if the type in question is a familiar one in the West, biblical influence must be presumed. What is most compelling about the type is an air of power coupled with the absence of any of the usual clues as to how the power might be used. In the case of absolutely every human character, we know that, though he may disclose nothing about his past, he has had one nonetheless. One that included a mother, a birth, and a mewling and puking infancy. As for his future, though he may disclose no intentions, we do not believe him to be without desires. A powerful manner can intimidate, but adults know that godlikeness resting on a denial of the past and the future can be nothing more than a pose. Just here, however, the analogy breaks down. God is not posing. He is not the Wizard of Oz. He is portrayed with apparent sincerity and unwavering consistency, as truly without a past, and, though not without intentions, as truly without desires except the desire that mankind should be his self-image. Otherwise, though his intentions, rudimentary at first, grow more complex, and though he is surprised by their effects and inclined to repudiate them, they are not the product of desire until very late in his story. At the start, and for a long while after the start, God relies on man even for the working out of his own intentions, and is to this extent almost parasitic on human desire. If man wanted nothing, it is difficult to imagine how God would discover what God wanted. Once we recognize God as dependent on human beings in this way, we may appreciate why, for him, the quest for a self-image is not an idle and optional indulgence, but the sole and indispensable tool of his self-understanding. If no one has painted your portrait, you as a human being still know who you are. Even if you have never seen yourself in a mirror, the same will be true. The person in the portrait, the person reflected in the mirror, is already in existence, and you know that person. Your history has both made you and made you a fact evident to yourself. God, as the Bible begins, is as yet unmade by any history and is therefore less than evident to himself. Though he is uniquely a protagonist who gives life itself to his antagonist, he is also, uniquely again, a protagonist who receives his life story from his antagonist. The story of God's life is the story of his life work, the creation of mankind in his own image. Concretely, that act of creation is achieved through the human history that constitutes the plot of the Bible. But this plot not only does not but cannot begin in medias res because God himself, who begins it, is so without history. There is, strange as it may sound to say this, too little to God at the start of the Bible for his story to begin that way. How then does it begin? When he tells mankind to be fertile and increase, God makes mankind's single defining action, the only positive action mankind is told to take, an image of the single action that, at the start, defines God himself. Mankind's fertility and self-multiplication then anger God, however, and a conflict is generated that moves the action forward. God discovers, after the fact, that unchecked fertility was not quite what he had in mind. He destroys creation with an enormous flood, only to discover that destruction was not what he had in mind either. He vows to Noah and his family, the only human survivors, that he will never destroy the world again, but he is now so riven that his vow is not altogether convincing. Then what? Historically speaking, as we noted in Chapter 2, Yahweh and Elohim seem to have separately absorbed the personality of a destroyer god rather like Babylonian Tiamat, the flood dragon, whose defeat by Babylonian Marduk was Babylonia's creation myth. By positing some such conflation of deities, historians can explain the origin of contradiction in the character of the god of the Tanakh. Yet, whatever the explanation, the contradiction must then be confronted as a literary reality. It is as if to say, yes, I understand, your father was a doctor, your mother was a spy, but now I must get to know you. After the biblical flood, and despite his reassuring vow never to destroy the world again, God retains a radical and ominous creative, destructive ambivalence. But if God's fusion of the personalities of creator and destroyer has consequences for his character, it also has consequences for the plot of the Bible. What the divine rejection of, on the one hand, unchecked human fertility, and on the other, any further destruction of the world, contributes to the plot is a compromise. A reproductive covenant with one part of mankind. Fertility is still promised, but it is no longer promised to mankind as a whole. Instead, it is promised exclusively, or at least preeminently, to Abraham and his descendants. And even this restricted fertility is not Abraham's sovereign possession. It is now a power exercised only in conjunction with God. In this new order, God's intervention permits Abraham and Sarah, yes, to conceive and bear in their old age, but Abraham's penis is no longer his own possession. As circumcision so well symbolizes, the organ and the power behind it now belong partly to God. The story of God as creator and mankind as progenitor unfolds like a jejune two-part musical invention that, by contrapuntal repetition and variation, becomes an elaborate and magnificent fugue. The sexual obsession of the early narrative gives it an extraordinary, primal, almost animal power. And yet there is something abstract about that very narrowness, that very intensity. The book of Genesis, at least until the story of Joseph, is a narrative of brutal single-mindedness. Barrenness, conception, birth, masturbation, seduction, rape, uxoricide, fratricide, infanticide. These are the terms of the action. The narrative is preoccupied with reproduction and threats to reproduction, to the exclusion of nearly everything else in human experience. But the narrative art of the Bible lies not just in the often noted power of these first biblical stories, but also, and even more, in the way it manages the emergence of subsequent, far more complex events from such schematic beginnings. And as the narrative grows more complex, it is able to contain and carry progressively more elaborate non-narrative material. Poetic, legal, and prophetic presentations of God as protagonist and of mankind as God's image and antagonist. In the book of Exodus, to which we turn next, the struggle between mankind and God over human reproductive power enters a decisive new phase. As this book opens, the reproductive covenant between the Lord and Abraham, which tamed the creator-destroyer conflict in the Lord God, has generated a new provocation and exposed a new conflict. This has happened because of the very success of the Abrahamic covenant. Abraham and his one son have become Isaac and his two, then Jacob and his 12, then the 12 and their 70. And finally, as the book of Exodus opens, a nation large enough to rival mighty Egypt. The Israelites were fertile and prolific. They multiplied and increased very greatly, so that the land was filled with them. As we noted earlier, the Lord's promise of fertility to Abraham was a clear, if implicit, revocation of his promise to the rest of mankind. But though its consequence might strike us as foreseeable, the Lord quite clearly has not foreseen it. In the terms of the narrative, of course, all these things are happening for the first time. There is no past from which to draw lessons for the future, and there is also no claim of omniscience. The Lord is caught off guard, as it were. He does not immediately respond when, as Israel begins to grow into a great nation on Egyptian territory, the Egyptians defend themselves by enslaving the Israelites. But the Egyptian defense is futile. With God's help, the Israelite numbers continue to grow, the Israelite women giving birth all but without labor. Finally, Egypt's ruler gives an order that directly contravenes God's wishes. Every boy that is born to the Hebrews you shall throw into the Nile. God has faced disobedience before, but never such outright defiance. His response to it will turn him for the first time into a warrior. But before we consider that change, we must consider the conflict that Pharaoh has exposed within God's own character. The outer Israelite-Egyptian conflict arises from this inner conflict. It was God, after all, who promised fertility to all men equally at creation, and who did so again after the flood, but who then promised, and delivered, a greater fertility to Abraham and his descendants. God is now confronted with the results of his inconsistent action. A powerful fertility loser is fighting back against God's designated fertility winner. How can the conflict be resolved? Remember that at the creation and after the flood, God told the Egyptians too, at least by inclusion, to be fertile and increase. One way to resolve the conflict, or better, one condition under which it would not have arisen, is polytheism. That is, a God who was of Abraham could coherently promise him superior fertility, as well as the possession of the land of the Kenites, the Kenizzites, the Kadmonites, and so forth. Other gods, comparably personal, comparably of the leaders of those other groups, could coherently promise their devotees the same. The results, it would be understood, would be settled on the field of battle. Meanwhile, the God of heaven, understood to be over all men as well as over all other gods, would refrain from making such narrow promises. And if the human rivals descended to outright warfare, the God of heaven could retain his universal jurisdiction by abstaining from battlefield alliance with the forces of any side. If keeping the God of heaven above the fray is one way to resolve the fertility conflict, another way is to turn the one God into a divine warrior. The God who is God of all may then take sides as if he were a God of. But he must pay the price of the contradiction by allowing a change to take place in his own character. He must assume another role in human affairs than would otherwise be his. In Genesis 24, we saw an early stage in the fusion of the high or sky God with the personal God of, when Abraham referred to the God who was to assist Abraham's servant in finding a wife for Isaac, a humble, lower-level errand, as the Lord, the God of heaven. Abraham's servant made the same identification when he prayed, O Lord, O God of my master Abraham. At the beginning of the book of Exodus, however, what was earlier only a tentative, implicit fusion becomes confident and explicit. The ofness of the Lord God is extended to the now huge nation of Israel, formalized by a covenant, and backed by the action of Yahweh, who now becomes an exceedingly warlike deity. In short, as in any effective plot, one action leads to another. God's creation leads to mankind's reproduction, which leads to war, which leads to God's taking part in the war. And as in any great work of literature, the deeper action is interior. It consists of the profound spiritual changes that the action works in the characters. It is as a consequence of Israel's fertility in Egypt that Yahweh, the Lord, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, is drawn into battle for the first time in his career. As he wages war, he is changed by what he does. War transforms him, and he becomes permanently a divine warrior. For the decisive and effectively the last time in the Tanakh, he adds to his character another entire divine personality, this time that of the ferocious Canaanite war god Baal. The relationship between the plot of the Bible and the character of monotheism's God, a deity who was historically a precipitate of Semitic polytheism, is thus intricate but coherent. First, the Creator, destroyer contradiction within this deity is resolved by a fertility covenant between God and one man. A focus on the private concerns of this one man effects a further fusion between, on the one hand, the still cosmic creator-destroyer deity, and on the other, the far humbler and more terrestrial personal God. Then, as Israel, super-fertile thanks to the covenant, threatens to dominate Egypt, the inherent tension in the high God-personal God fusion requires for its alleviation that the Lord become and remain a warrior in addition to whatever else he is. The equation is Creator, Yahweh slash Elohim, plus Cosmic Destroyer, Tiamat, plus Personal God, God of, plus Warrior, Baal, equals God, the composite protagonist of the Tanakh. Historically speaking, the several elements were not combined in this simple order. The plotting of these elements, their narrative presentation in the opening books of the Tanakh, represents the literary achievement of a number of writers in a process whose complexity historical scholarship will never be finished charting. However, this literary achievement rests on a prior intellectual synthesis, a feat of religious rather than literary creativity. It was only as a set of several gods was imagined into a unity dynamic with unresolved tensions that the path was broken for the writing of a story of God in which the full complexity of a character with multiple personalities could be presented, and the tensions within that character could be coherently and progressively revealed. Did the telling of the stories create the god, or did the god, imagined first, provoke the telling of the stories? By stressing how recalcitrant a subject for storytelling this being without history or desire is, how uninteresting in all ordinary human and literary ways, I have already suggested which answer I think the more plausible. A shared idea of God must have come first, not that it can have come all at once. Only the fact that it was shared can explain how so large a number of writers working separately over so long a period of time could have produced a work that, in all its variety, has a deep underlying unity. Historical critical scholarship, having assigned different parts of different biblical books to different writers, as well as, more recently, different and vastly expanded roles to different later redactors, has changed forever the way the Bible is read. But the unity of the Bible was not imposed entirely after the fact by clever editing. That unity rests ultimately on the singularity of the Bible's protagonist, the one God, the Monos Theos of monotheism. This God arose as a fusion, to be sure, but not of all prior gods, only of several. The inner contradictions that were the result of the fusion took shape, quite early on, as a finite set of inner contradictions. It was the biblical writer's common intellectual grasp of this set of contradictions, this set and no other, that permitted them, working over centuries, to contribute to the drawing of a single character. Literarily speaking, the Bible is unique on several counts, of which three may be mentioned at this point. First of all, it is a translated classic. Only a minority of those for whom it has functioned as a classic over the centuries have read it in the languages in which it was written. Second, in an oddly modern way, it is a classic with a choice of orderings and endings that depends on the reader. The reader must choose to read it either as the Tanakh, the Hebrew Bible, or as the Christian Bible with the Old Testament in its distinct order, and with the New Testament as an alternate ending. A third, more important, but less easily formulated count on which the Bible is literarily unique, however, is the character of its central narrative. The long narrative that fills the first 11 books of the Bible, stretching from the creation of the world through the fall of Jerusalem, has sometimes been called a saga, but it is not. The word saga, though now often used of any long story of historical origins, refers paradigmatically to several works in classical Icelandic. Though, like the Bible, these tell the story of a nation's origins, and though they contain various miraculous or supernatural episodes, no single being is their protagonist, as God is the protagonist of the Bible. Nor is the biblical narrative like a classical epic. Though the Greek gods play a large role in the classical epic and biblical narrative differ in their conception of time. The epics, vast as they seem, are understood to cover only a crucial period in a much longer temporal framework. All the gods, as well as all the human characters, have pasts, old grudges, vows to discharge, scores to settle, and destinies to fulfill as the action begins. The richly textured, densely populated feeling that characterizes the classical epics, right from their immortal opening lines, contrasts with the open weave, so to call it, the relative barrenness and emptiness of the Bible in its opening moments. The biblical narrative, whose distinctness every reader or hearer immediately and intuitively senses, works as it does because God, its all-defining protagonist, is a character without a past. A protagonist without a past yields a narrative without a memory, a narrative that is radically forward-looking and open-ended because, given its protagonist, it has no other alternative. The chain of events that turns Yahweh into a warrior and all but catapults the Lord God forward begins when the Israelites were groaning under the bondage and cried out, and their cry for help from the bondage rose up to God. God heard their moaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. God looked upon the Israelites, and God took notice of them. It is to the continuation of this story that we now turn.